want to call the Customer Service and Operations Committee to order. Before this is the agenda for today, are there any questions about the agenda? Hearing none, accept it. May we have a motion for approval of the minutes? Mr. Bolger, second. Mr. Koska. Any questions? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed. This morning we are going to have two items of information on our agenda, and the first one is the Vital Signs Quarterly Report. We're going to be have a presentation for our Chief Performance Officer, Ms. Burnside, and she will be updating us on our key performance indicators that we have been monitoring over safety, security, and service reliability and customer satisfaction. We welcome all of this good news for the customers and our visitors about Metro's new approach to our track work that will be the next information item, and that one will be presented by Mr. Troop. So I want to go ahead and let's begin with the first item. Ms. Burnside will bring us up to date on the vital signs for this quarter.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. This report today covers our performance for the first quarter of the calendar year of 2014, January, February, and March, and compared to the same time period last year. Our performance results are a mixed bag for that quarter. While we've seen five measures improving and then five worsening, and I think as a general statement, I could say that we experienced seasonal challenges for some of our key measures of service quality, but we did have some improvement in escalator availability and some of our safety measures like employee injury rates and crime rates. So when I talk about seasonal challenges, it's kind of hard to talk about that today when it's supposed to get up to 80-something, I think, degrees. But in fact, not too long ago, we had single-digit temperatures. And when we think of problems with service, we often think of snow. But in fact, it's really the single-digit temperatures, the very cold weather. Snow obviously has an impact, but it's the very cold weather that really impacted us during the quarter. For bus on-time performance, overall for the quarter, it improved very slightly compared to the same time last year. We achieved 79% on-time performance. As you know, our target's 81%. It's just about a half percentage point above last year. And while we saw multiple bus service improvements and service changes on a number of routes during the quarter, and that drove on-time performance in a positive way, some of those gains were offset, again, by the single-digit temperatures and the on-time performance associated with delays and service challenges during the cold weather. So overall, the net gain was just a small improvement over last year for bus. Moving to the rail side, we were also challenged to stay on time. And, you know, I should note that we purposefully widened our headways, which kind of purposefully drove on-time performance down. So due to the severe cold and widening, as our passenger volumes declined, we didn't run as much service on purpose. We achieved an on-time performance of 90.5%, and that was almost 2 percentage points lower than the same time period last year. It was beneficial operationally to widen the headways and reduce the service because it helped our rail fleet and infrastructure be protected from the punishing cold and snow, but it did impact our on-time performance. As mentioned, our fleet suffered in the extreme temperatures. The conditions affected every single type of bus in the fleet and caused our reliability to drop 25% compared to last year. And buses depend on air compressor systems that were impacted by the severe conditions. So we saw significant mechanical failures, 30% more than last year. In particular, Copper Airlines froze. They're not designed to tolerate these cold conditions. And those caused things like frozen air dryers and clogged airlines. Air pressure is required to operate the brakes and pneumatic components like the doors. One of our momentum strategic initiatives, if you may remember, is to better prepare Metro for extreme weather. And so some of the lessons learned from the single-digit temperatures we'll be applying. And, in fact, for example, right now, Jack may want to say more about it, but we're in communications with our manufacturers to come up with insulation for some of these copper airlines so that we can better harden our buses for the future. If we were situated in a much colder climate, we would buy buses that already have those components on them, but you don't expect those kind of single-digit temperatures here, so we don't buy our buses with those. But with the climate swinging back and forth, we may need to consider that. Rail cars performed 20% below last year. That was driven down to car and related truck failures, particularly in January. And similar to the bus, we had challenges with our rail car equipment. In the brake systems, moisture in the brake lines sometimes froze and prevented air pressure from building and reaching the brakes. This means that the brakes don't engage. The systems are designed to fail safe, meaning that the brakes don't release, and so the train can't move. We saw some of the highest delays due to brakes since 2012, so for the past couple of years. And then power failure delays also spiked in January. And I will note that my understanding is that newer rail cars with modern brake systems are less likely to have these type of failures during the cold weather. Is that a correct statement, Rob? Our customer injury rate at 2.12 worsened in the quarter compared to the same period last year. We had slippery conditions, obviously, which led to increase in slips and falls and an increase in road collisions. Collisions were up 53%. And that contributed to this key performance indicator falling below target by the end of the quarter. On the positive side, the employee injury rate improved 10% over last year. As you know, we've had substantial efforts to reduce employee injuries through initiatives like fatigue management that we talked to you about and our at-risk program. The at-risk program targets communications and actions at employees that frequently get injured. And that program has seen a 32% reduction in those categorized as at risk since its inception. So it's been a big success. Escalator availability continued all quarter to be better than target and then last year by almost 3 percentage points. Repairs were being completed faster, and replacement work continued at 5 stations, Georgia Avenue, Columbia Heights, Bethesda, Friendship Heights, and Mount Vernon Square. Escalator preventive maintenance compliance was at 95%, you know, reaching nearly 100% compared to only 58% a year ago. So that has a very positive impact. We also added more technicians this year so that when we did have to respond to an outage, they could respond faster. And the type of things that they had to respond to, because our preventive maintenance is up very high, were things like panels being loose or trash stuff, so they didn't really take that much time to address, and you can get the escalator back in service quicker. On the other hand, elevator availability was just slightly better than the same period last year, but it didn't meet our target. As a general statement, we saw our maintenance shifting from scheduled to unscheduled work for elevators. We had some complex repairs, it was PG Plaza and Wheaton, that required more time than usual for safety inspections to be completed. And we experienced water intrusion at a number of stations, McPherson Square, West Hyattsville, Wheaton, and those took our units out of service for long periods of time. We're implementing better ways to track and report both escalator and elevator availability using remote monitoring technology. Moving to crime rate, it's a positive story. Crime was down on both bus and rail this quarter when compared to the same time last year. The one area that did see an increase, one of the factors of the crime rate, is in parking facilities. As you know, we've had a very positive impact on crime in the parking areas. And in this particular period, it was up a little bit. And that was really due to a couple of events in which multiple cars were targeted at Glenmont and Fort Totten. And those two stations accounted for about 40 of our parking lot crimes during the period, but arrests were made and those issues were addressed. Okay, moving to customer satisfaction. We have retooled our survey process, as I think you know, over the past year and a half. And so our most recent data is a little bit outside of the time period of the other key performance indicators. We're reporting on the last part of calendar year 2013. We're going to catch up soon so that we're reporting all the same time period for the key performance indicators. As a general statement, we've seen our satisfaction trend unfavorably for both bus and rail. So overall, 76% were satisfied or very satisfied, and that's down from the 80s in prior periods. And that's largely due to perceived service reliability challenges. But on the other hand, we've seen some positive gains in the input from our customers in these surveys. Rail satisfaction was kind of on the rail side, was greatly impacted by several major delays that occurred during the month of November. As you may remember, we had a bad month, so those impacted the satisfaction levels. So as I mentioned, on the positive side, we're seeing some favorable results from our customer care focus with our key frontline employees, namely bus operators and station managers. You've heard about the We Care program for the bus operators. Bus operators are regarded as approachable, and the majority of respondents for our satisfaction survey, 75%, said they were greeted when boarding the bus. Interaction and operator friendliness is the number one driver of customer satisfaction, so we've been working on that, and it seems to be having a positive impact. About 24% of the respondents for the satisfaction survey engage with station managers, and a large majority of those, almost 90%, said that those employees were knowledgeable and courteous. And finally, I think we're on the last slide here, coming attractions. Our spring break is obviously over now, and we've resumed our system maintenance efforts to improve reliability and get ready for the summer. And this segues into Mr. Troop's presentation about our new approach to track work as we enter the high season for tourism. But before we go to Mr. Troop, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Burnside. I guess we can sum that up. The things that were more under our control, we were able to stay on target. Those that were not, we were most effective by it. So, Mr. Acosta, you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question about, let's go back to extreme weather issues. What were some of the lessons learned, and what are some of the things that we may do differently next year based on our experiences? We've encountered both on the rail and the bus side.
Well, I think on the bus side is, again, is the challenges of extreme weather, either heat or cold. And as Andrea mentioned, from the cold standpoint, you know, and all of our buses, nearly all of our buses are parked outside, so they're suffering through the cold hours. You know, we do attempt to run every bus for 10 or 15 minutes every couple hours to try to keep the systems up and running. But again, if there's a weakness in a system, it comes out when the temperatures drop down below 20 degrees or certainly down to the 10. Again, as Andrea said, we're evaluating some additional things that we could do to the systems to try to improve them. And that's really what our experience will be over the next few months, is to try to find ways of trying to maintain that higher level of reliability. But a little bit of moisture in a system, an air system, it freezes up, and that does shut the bus down. And, you know, fortunately, ridership is usually down on those days. But, again, we're still trying to keep the reliability of the fleet up. But as soon as the weather warmed up in February and March, we, you know, immediately jumped up, 1,500 miles between road calls. And, you know, as the months go on, the numbers get higher. So it's definitely something related directly to the cold and the wetness of the winter months.
Jack, follow on in our earlier. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry.
Did you finish? No, I think it's Robert's, but go ahead.
Okay. No, yeah, we can go ahead.
In our pre-presentation, we heard that the CNG and the hybrid buses have a tough time in the winter because of what you talked about, Jack. Is that a specification issue?
No, I think one thing is that is almost all of our fleet now. We have 460 compressed natural gas buses and about 700 hybrids. So, you know, we're well over, 75%. So I don't think it's not related to the fuel that's being used. I think it's first of all, our CNG buses, the newest one is 2005. So, you know, we've got 8 or 9 years, life on all CNG buses, and some actually are going to be beginning to be replaced in the next couple of years. So, no, I don't think it's fuel that's the issue.
Specifications.
The bus specifications are the same. It's the fuel is the only difference between the two buses. The hybrid systems work in the winter. The CNG is not an issue in the winter other than issues with the quality of the gas that we get. But that isn't related to, we don't put the poor quality gas into the system, and so that doesn't impact the reliability during that time of the year.
Any other questions?
I think Rob was going to say something.
Yeah, certainly. You know, one of the things with rail, particularly when it snows and the federal government shuts down, is we do widen the headways intentionally then. We widen the headways intentionally during the peak periods because we're not servicing as many customers. So as a result of widening the headways, we actually take a hit on our on-time performance. Outside of that, one of the issues, one of the larger issues we have is with our air compressors. So we actually have campaigns that are ongoing to be able to redistribute the way that we do air so that one car doesn't affect the whole train, that one compressor can take up for another compressor. So we have engineering and maintenance campaigns that we're doing for them. Also, one of the other issues that we have is with the coupler heads between cars. When you take cars apart, the electrical components that have to go between cars, there's a coupler head that fits in like this. What happens is when you constantly are taking this apart, you have a tendency to get snow in there, and then that can cause problems with the brake lines because the information isn't being carried back and forth between cars. So to try to minimize as much of the taking apart and putting cars back together again as we can is always important, and recognize, and Rodrigo, is the 5K is the one that we have a lot of problems with propulsion, or the 4? The 4K. The 4K is the one we have a lot of problems with the propulsion system, so the intent is to try and draw as many of those out as we can, and run other servers, just because of the way the configuration with the motor is when it gets snow up under there, under the undercarriage. So that's some of the things that we look at. But with the coming 7K, and boy, we're hoping that it's going to be very, very reliable, is that we won't be taking the cars apart as much with that.
Just one quick follow-up, too, as we move into the summer and extreme heat issues. I mean, how are we can you talk a little bit about how we're preparing ourselves for air conditioning, for instance, and other types of things that may occur?
Yeah, Rodrigo, can you come up and why don't you just talk a little bit about our campaigns for the
Good morning. Currently, we're having campaigns primarily on the 1,000 series cars and the 5,000 series cars, but the campaigns just not started yesterday. We actually have been working on the HVAC conditioning systems all winter long and since fall, precisely to getting prepared to this coming summer. I don't have the numbers over here, but we had a presentation months ago where the actually air conditioning the trains performed better last year than the years past, so we're targeting to even improve upon that, and the systems were more reliable last year than in years past. So with these two initiatives on the 1,000 series and the 5,000 series, we're expected to be able to have even better performance. The 2s and 3s and the 6s and the 4s really didn't have major problems last year. We were looking for all kinds of leaks in the system that we had, mm-hmm. especially in the 5,000 series, and the maintenance practices across the fleet, basically. So we're more in compliance with the PMs done in the units. And those two are two primary issues that we're doing. On the 5,000 series, we're looking at the control boxes on the HVAC units that showed high failure rate last summer on the electronic side.
Okay. Right. Is that it? Thank you very much, Andre. And now we'll go to the next presentation from Mr. Troop. And this is, I think, an interesting and exciting presentation because we've had the interruptions with our customers in terms of trying to keep our state of goat repair, and I think this is the one way that we're going to keep our customers more informed and being able to continue that progress that we're making. Mr. Fruit.
Thank you. And good morning. You know, I'm always pleased to be able to talk to the board about our customer service efforts, and you know, this is truly how I feel about our Metro Ford rebuilding campaign. It is about our customer focus and ensuring safety and reliability. You know, which are ultimately the biggest drivers of customer satisfaction. We have been successful over the past years in fully developing a state of good repair program, all while increasing our safety awareness and our safe work practices. The necessity for the aggressive rebuilding campaign is the result of deferred maintenance and the substantial backlog that we had, and as a result of, like I said, the deferred maintenance items. It's also the result of closing out priority items such as the guarded number eights and the Generation 2 track circuits. Ultimately, we will get to a steady state of maintenance, and production then will become very programmatic and also predictable. We are making headway towards our goal of steady state. Our work with the crosstie state of good repair illustrates this point effectively. As you can see, the resultant production efforts require not just replacement of defects through the normal attrition, but also the replacement of those ties which were deferred. All of this requires time and space, and I am pleased to report that our backlog in both rail and fasteners will be done by the end of this fiscal year. So it shows the kind of production and how we're moving towards getting this backlog taken care of. There is a proportional effect of time and space and resources that is directly relational to production. Time and space are necessary to get the work done as resources are constrained by work activities. In order to get the necessary production, we need to increase the time and space that is available on the railroad. We get this from non-revenue hours and borrowing that time from our passengers during regular service periods. This is a critical balancing act, and I learned about this as a young ATC construction engineer at Amtrak. I was running an ATC cutover at Grace Interlocking, which is next to the Susquehanna River, and there's a drawbridge there, and it wasn't going well. In fact, I basically had the entire Northeast Corridor shut down because the drawbridge circuits were in the open position, which meant that no trains could get through. The chief dispatcher called to say that the Metroliner was coming, and he had to have his railroad back in 15. And, you know, that shows you how long ago it was when the Metroliner was the hot train. So I told him, Chief, I'm putting a signal system in here, and I need a few more minutes. And he told me, he said, son, Amtrak's not in the business of installing signal systems. We're in the business of moving people. You know, and that was an epiphany for me. And the same is true here. We can't lose sight of what our mission is. But as I said before, the business is all to ensure a safe and reliable ride. The balancing act is best if it is predictable and can be planned deliberately and with the least impact to service. As we go through the rebuilding program, we continually readjust our production operations plan because we understand that we need to move towards a steady state. In addition, we look for ways to minimize the track outages and with minimal risk to safety and service as well. So we need to reduce backlog, maintain a steady state of good repair, and do important safety work such as track circuit replacement, in addition to federally mandated projects such as the neutral host and the T-band relocation. All of these require on-track work periods. The effort is significant and necessary, but we know that it's not sustainable from a business perspective, that this level of inconvenience to our passengers cannot continue indefinitely. Without adverse risk to ridership and also from an employee fatigue perspective. You know, the authority has been actively engaged in a comprehensive fatigue management assessment. And the science of fatigue says it's much more than just hours of service, but also consecutive days of work and even shift starting times, which can have an adverse effect on an employee who is actively engaged in work. What is important here is to understand that this is a comprehensive fatigue management program. It is not about regulatory limitations, but by instituting thoughtful shift times and production schedules for wayside workers to assist the employees in getting the proper amount of rest. Our progress has allowed us to better begin balancing all of those needs, and moving into the next fiscal year, we will look at means and methods to maintain our required production levels while still ensuring passenger needs are met and the fatigue management program can be fully implemented. What we're able to do is begin to better balance our production requirements to more long-term sustainable initiatives. We will start many of our shutdowns later, around 12 o'clock midnight on Friday. We will still have some shutdowns at 10, but only when the work activities require us to maximize the available hour in order to return to service, normal service Monday morning or Tuesday should we have a three-day weekend. Our work activities such as switch replacements are example of these types of production efforts. In addition, we will vastly reduce the number of consecutive weekend shutdowns that occur, and on rare occasions have consecutive weekend shutdowns when we need to maintain the continuity of work, when we have specific contractual obligations to be able to provide those weekends. Again, large switch installations such as the Silver Line connection would be example of these types of work. I've talked before about how important it is for us to capitalize on the time and space we borrow from our passengers. And I want to illustrate this again with our shutdown coordination document. Note that the red semicircles are individual pieces of on-track equipment, and we have multiple departments working multiple projects, including all-in-one shutdown, the track circuit upgrades, tie replacement, station platform work, fasteners, welds, ETS box replacement, station platform rehabilitation, and platform edge lights. We get a lot of activities within the same work zone. Implementation of these new work hours and processes makes sense from a customer service and a fatigue management perspective, but it does mean we're giving up valuable time and space when we can do work. Note that the science of fatigue tells us that moving to daytime creates a natural environment where a person's effectiveness is increased. In addition, cumulative effects and time for recovery are lessened if normal night sleep patterns can be maintained. However, we do move people during the day, and we had attempted to do day work earlier, but we realized that the low production levels and disruption to passengers did not achieve that important balance that I spoke of earlier. But now we have looked at it more systematically because we are in a more programmed approach to work. So by programming work on the outer edges, we can maximize the production and create schedules where there is where work is of no impact or near zero impact to operations. In other words, our passenger headways are not affected by the single tracking. This is best shown through the illustration of work, which we will move forward on the green line to accommodate the test track work during the day. Note that the 12-minute headways between Greenbelt and Fort Taunton will remain as they do now. Passengers continue to see the same service and service headways that they would during normal daytime off-peak periods. The northbound core headway from Lafont to Fort Taunton still averaged 6 minutes, with the train arriving every 4 minutes, followed by 1 8 minutes later, and then another 4 minutes later, or a 4-8-4-8 pattern. Similarly, for King Street to Pentagon, there is a 5-7-5-7 northbound pattern. Again, this maximizes our opportunity to do productive work while still maintaining balanced customer service and expectations. We do this by establishing long-range plans that can be programmatic to our steady-state maintenance needs, our fatigue management requirements, and most importantly, to our passengers who need consistent, reliable, and safe transport. Because we have reduced, and I want to emphasize reduced, not eliminate, our backlog, we can be less reactive to issues everywhere and more purposeful in targeting efficiency in our steady state maintenance production. Thank you, and I'd certainly be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Troop. I think the really exciting part about this is the fact that we acknowledge what the impact has been and is on the customer, but setting a process in place that gives some expectation that can govern, they can govern their time, and we can still maintain our safety direction and our commitment to state of good repair. And I think it'll be interesting as we go through this. And let me open it up for questions. And are there any questions? Mr. Bulger.
Rob, this is very good news for our customers, particularly after all the we've asked them to endure, particularly on weekends, and we hope that this new reorganization of work is going to produce the same results. Which does this still match up with what we're doing in the capital program, or is this just been reorganized, but work reorganized in a different fashion?
Well, I think it, as far as the production levels, you know, the intent is still to get to 2017 to reduce, you know, basically all the backlog items that we have. We still maintain that construction effort level. Again, and that's kind of why we're saying if we lose the time and space here, we need to make up for it somewhere else, but again, in a way that isn't impactful to the passengers. So, but what we have been able to do, what's important to understand is that because, like I said, we have basically essentially eliminated the backlog in rail, we will eliminate the backlog in fasteners by the end of the fiscal year. The time that was necessary for that, we can now start, you know, through that attrition, be able to reduce those time elements as necessary. In other words, we're not just going to be out there working because we have the ability to do it. You know, we need to balance against it. So, like I said, what's important is, yes, we understand, you know, what the passengers have endured during the weekend. We reduce that when we can through a normal process, not just, you know, okay, we're going to cut it off here in 2017 is when you're going to get it back. It's going to be a slow attrition of being able to do that. So from the capital perspective, from the wayside, you know, the intent is, you know, things like the track circuit replacements will not suffer. You know, the neutral host is a job which should start back again pretty soon. We'll figure out a way to get into there and do those kinds of things. But, you know, what we also are looking at is being able to, you know, be able to maximize that time and space again with zero disruption to our passengers. If we have opportunities. We've done studies. We've been able to look at where we have three single tracking events, like, say, on the Red Line, we could actually have three signal tracking events. There would be no different than having two. Right now, we limit ourselves to two on the outside or one in the core. We've done analysis to show, okay, you know what, we can go in and do three single tracking events. So that gives us another time and space where we can put people to be able to work. There will be a zero or near zero disruption to our passengers. So, you know, as we become more sophisticated in our planning, and as the program allows us to do that, because remember, what happened is we had this deferred maintenance, and every place fasteners were bad. You know, we could not defer fasteners in one area. Now we're at a point where, you know what, we can say, you know what, we can defer this for a year. We know we got to get back that in that year, but if we need to, we know that we can defer it for 6 months or a year to be able to move back. Before, we couldn't defer anything. We had to get in, do this, get in, do that, get in, do that. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. I just think okay. It's a turning point. I think the board should realize we're making a huge turn here for the good of the system and for our customers.
Thank you. Ms. Porter and Ms. Hines.
I wanted to just explore a little bit about this, the weekday single tracking at the ends of the lines. It sounds like you're planning to do the thing between Greenbelt and College Park as sort of a pilot project to just sort of see how it works. Is that sort of the idea?
Well, we're going to do that. I don't know that I would consider it a pilot project because, you know, we're pretty sure how the service will run there. But, yeah, I mean, that is the one that we're first attacking. We're setting up the schedules to be able to do that. We know we have issues with the test track. And again, what's interesting is that, you know, we get the test track done quicker. That means the 7K can go onto the test track, which means the 7K is no longer taking up space on the right-of-way because the track usage meetings on Thursday are very, very interesting. You know, it'd be nice to see, you know, get a camera in there. You see how people are very, you know, advocate for their jobs. They're in there, you know, and it gets bloody sometimes. But, you know, being able to move that, you know, that work outside and get that test tracks done. So that's, again, kind of how we prioritize that.
And just sort of explore how this works. You say you can do it without changing headways at all for the rest of the line. And sometimes when they come to the end of the line, they sit there and wait for a while. So presumably what you're doing is you're having them wait a shorter period of time.
Yeah,
so they come in and leave instead of sitting there at the end of the line and waiting.
Yeah, what
is that basically how you're doing it, moving them faster?
Right, exactly. Okay. The train would come in, we'd actually have a turnback operator. So what happens is we have an operator at the what would be the end of the train that comes in and is getting ready to turn. So this operator steps off the train, that operator steps right onto the train, tees it up. So you don't have an operator that has to, you know, walk through the train and you know, while that person's keying it up and getting the test, that person's walking through and making an assessment of the train so that, you know, you can turn around much quicker. So, yes, that's exactly what happens. The trains won't be waiting. They'll make an immediate turn.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So I want to understand, too, probably a different aspect, Rob, of the daytime. So I'm looking, for instance, at just in the appendix at July 14th to July 17th, which is a week, and it's a Monday to a Thursday, I guess, or Monday to a Friday. We have work going on several different lines, three or four different lines. What will that mean for the customer in terms of the fact that you're working on these lines? Is because you're maintaining the headways, you're saying people are not going to notice?
Well, I want to be very clear about something. The appendix is the nighttime work. There still will be affected works for the nighttime single
this
trackings.
This is nighttime work only.
Yeah, in the appendix.
Oh,
yes. I'm sorry.
I did
yes,
not
yes,
understand
yes. I'm sorry.
That.
Yes.
So
okay.
Maybe I missed that because I came
okay.
late to the meeting.
Okay.
Because we have been working so much on shutdowns on the weekends, I hadn't really focused on nighttime work during the week.
Yes.
So
there still will be certain extended headways. You know. you know, with them. And again, we push those to 10 o'clock. Those are 10 o'clock starts on there. But again, it's generally, you know, the traffic is lighter. And
okay. Yeah. Well, then let me ask mm-hmm. a very specific question then, because Clarendon to Ballston is mm-hmm. shows up here quite a lot for mm-hmm. Third Rail. That's a busy stretch mm-hmm. for lots of things that don't start much before 11 o'clock mm-hmm. at night, even on Wednesdays, as I'm learning in my other job. So they're going to single track, or their trains will be doing bus bridges?
I believe if you're looking at single track, that'll be a single track.
That'll be single track. So the trains will still be running. One of my concerns is there's a lot of slides here. I'm presuming you have something that's Virginia specific, Maryland specific, and DC specific. You don't. It's just all. We need to find a way.
We think regionally.
Yeah, I know you do. I know, but the bids and the businesses think very locally, and their eyes will glaze over at a chart like this. So I guess my question really is, how can we communicate this succinctly to our businesses and our business improvement districts about how this is different from what they've been dealing with for the last several years, and how they should think about this in terms of moving forward?
I think from a single track perspective at night, it is no different. From the single track perspective, there is no difference at night. What changes, though, is for the shutdown events, that like I said, you know, we're not doing consecutive weekends, so you're not going to see nearly as many shutdown events. And we do try to liaison, you know, the media relations office liaisons with local businesses to try to understand ahead what events are out there. Certainly, I think Lynn is here. Lynn's here. You know, so you know, they're in constant contact with her office in regard. So any events that they may have, it's important to get them out to us early so that we can plan out, because we're actually planned out probably a year in advance for our shutdown events and most of our single tracking events. Generally, the single tracking events are cut in stone in an 8-week period because of some of the variabilities on that. But it's important that they get that information out to us as soon as they can. So if we can plan around it.
Well, I will say for my part, I've been pushing it out, too, from my office to them so that they're not trying to remember. They have to tell you something.
Right.
So anything we can do to put this into a more accessible format for them would be helpful.
Yeah. May I follow
up? Lynn, do you want to talk to that? Do you need to?
I would just add that we do visit with the bids, and we try to walk through any concerns that they have with respect to special events. It's on the web. They do get weekly updates from us as part of their subscription to news releases and other things. We even, the general manager got a request from an individual who was planning her wedding this fall and wanted to know what the track work schedule was, so that when she sent out her her notice of travel to all of her guests invited to the wedding, that she could tell them whether or not to ride Metro. So we will handle individual cases as they arise. We were very glad to be able to report that her wedding, which is in October, does not conflict with the track work schedule. No, I assure you, Mr. Batar did not. It was just good luck. Hopefully that bodes well for her pending nuptials. In fact, the challenge that we really have with the communities is that so many of them are on a schedule with their events, and they like to have it the same weekend each year. And so there's not a lot of flexibility in their planning, and so we're respectful of that. What we do is we look at ridership, and we look at their event attendance. And oftentimes we find that we're absolutely able to accommodate people on buses, even though the rail shutdown is in place. In fact, we've had a lot of very positive feedback about people's experience on the very short bus bridge, bus shuttle. And Jack accommodates thousands and thousands of people that way. Where we do try to be a little bit more flexible is on events where you're talking about tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, because we want people to be able to travel safely and reliably. And even where we can't change a single tracking operation, Rob's group is very sensitive about trying to do what they can, so sometimes that means additional 8-car trains gap trains to fill in to create more frequency during the hours of an event. And we do that kind of planning. So we try to be responsive to the community concerns that, that are brought to our attention.
Ms. Porter, you have an additional question?
I was just going to follow up. Looking at the list here, I noticed that you've got a shutdown that begins on July 4th. I assume that's going to be very late in the day on July 4th. The first of the thing.
College Park
Greenbelt. It's at the end of the line, but still, July 4th carries probably the heaviest. It's a single tracking. I'm sorry, a shutdown of a single track, and it's going to start at, I assume, like midnight or something. You're not going to like. You're not going to shut down the single track at 6 p.m. You're going to shut it down at like midnight, something like that.
Yeah, traditionally, the single tracking is the early outs. What we call early outs is 10 p.m. Rarely is 8 nowadays. It's more like 10. But we're going to be gauging the traffic, and if we need to hold back, we hold back until we transportation give us a go-ahead.
Because my understanding is you normally run extra trains on the 4th of July.
That is true. Okay. That is true. But there's a lot of communication over there. We set up the equipment. We set up the people. We're ready to go, but we are not clear to go into the system until transportation give us the go-ahead. And that is that happens after they have cleared whatever event. Okay. Is that being 4th of July in this case, but right now it's baseball season, and that's a really good example. Everybody's waiting on a pattern over there, just waiting until we receive the go-ahead, we're clear to go. And there's constant communication, text communication, email communication, all kinds of communication, so we can deploy without impacting the event in this case. This
is okay, good. Thank you.
Mr. Dyke, Mr. Downing.
Just a simple logistical question to follow up on that. What are the plans for this coming Monday now that we've shifted the Lady Gaga concert?
Or the Wizards.
Yes, it's now Monday the 14th. We've got tickets. That's why I'm asking. What's it?
Seated. Mr. Downing.
Yeah. I'm looking at the long appendix on single-track operations and noting, after checking my calendar, some of those are weekends, some of those are weekdays. And some of the same scheduling approach of maintaining headways would be applied both weekend and weekday.
No, single-tracking. We will have schedule impacts for the single trackings on the night. It's only the daytime work when we're talking about near zero impact to operations. So we do lengthen the headways out at night and at night.
We might still be saying 24 minutes.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. Yeah.
But we do it in such a way that the trains are not waiting. The trains are moving through the system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like they did a couple of years ago, sit there and wait for a train to come the opposite direction. That should not occur.
And where you have a piece of work that goes 3 days and then another 3 days, you've got a crew that is assigned to that piece of work.
Yes.
And
comes
back the next day. And
right, yes,
where
yes.
They,
where
they work.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what efficiency are you getting out of the crews with this 3 day? Are they doing a full work week in those 3 days? And is that their schedule?
Basically what we have is that's not quite their schedule, but we do work 12-hour shifts.
Yeah.
And the reason being is because the mobilization in and mobilization in mm-hmm. out is what we consider to be non-productive time. So naturally, just what you have is if you're mobilizing in and out three times within a non-productive period, that averages out about 2 to 3 hours, sometimes 4, depending on where the work location is. So your efficiency increases from a 65% if you're doing three ins and outs to almost an 80-85%, if you're doing 12-hour shifts. So we do work them as a 12-hour shift to that extent.
And I don't know the question, but I'll wait a minute until it comes back to my mind. Oh, no, I was going to say, what steps will you be taking, particularly with respect to the weekdays, where you're trying to maintain weekday headways, of reporting on how well we're doing at producing that service?
The way that report will come out will be with the vital signs report. Any impact that we show, I will immediately know about. I get the daily reports on on-time performance. So if we were to see where it would be very impactful, you know, where it wasn't in year zero, we'd pull out of the work, and he would have to go work in the yards or something.
But in the weighing of things, definitely we want to balance customer service and safe implementation of work, but
right.
We can't let the one dominate the other.
Particularly in the daytime.
Yeah.
You know, the customer service is weighted much more heavily than the productive work elements. And obviously safety is a prime concern, anything that we do, but that's what we look at mostly for the daytime
customers
work.
Customers really need to understand, we really need to keep emphasizing, if we don't do this work long term, we have
right.
sacrificed both your service and your safety.
Right.
Any other questions at this time?
I do want to point one thing out, if I could, very quickly. You know, when I was the AGM, I had a very easy job. I tell these guys, you know, I was able to take a big hammer to the rock and just start blasting away at it. And I do want to take a minute to thank Rodrigo and his team, because they've had to take a fine chisel to this. This is now redefining those work efforts. It gets a lot more difficult, like I said. You know, it's a lot more industrial engineering exercise to get these kinds of efficiencies. So I really appreciate the work that he and his crew have done to be able to pull this off. So,
thank you. Mr. Downey. Downs, sorry. It's a D. It's a D.
First, I want to add my thanks to you and the general manager and all the rest of the staff about making this accommodation. I think it sends the right message to our customers that what we're trying to balance out between what customers expect of us and the work that we have to do, that we're constantly experimenting with ways of making this less intrusive for our customers. At the recent JCC meeting, a question was asked about the ability when single tracking of stopping trains only in one direction during a single tracking. And I know several transit systems do this, and I was wondering if you had a reaction about that suggestion.
I'm not quite sure. Can you clarify?
During the single tracking,
mm-hmm.
Stopping and holding trains only in the one direction, they have a way of maintaining better headways and system, you know, on systems.
If I understand, I mean, it's stopping trains and holding them while they're waiting for the single track to
yep.
go through. We try to accommodate the schedules as best we can. One of the things that we don't want to do is, if I understand the question, is we don't like to move a train off the platform while another train is going through the single track section, just because we don't want to, you know, we don't want to have a situation where, for whatever reason, you know, we have a switch failure or something, now we have people stuck in the tunnel. So a lot of times it's purposeful that we hold them there while the one train is doing. But again, you know, that should be minimized to the extent possible. Additionally, if I understand the question further, one thing we do is, like within the core, we do run get a lot more gap trains. Like we'll run and turn trains back, you know, so that we may have, you know, 20 minutes, you know, from the single tracking to the outside, but we may have, you know, maybe 12 or 8 minute headways, you know, within the core because we're doing turn back trains, you know, at up there at Totten or Grosvenor or something like that. So, you know, that's kind of what we look for in regards to that. So we do try to maximize our schedule so that people are moving and not stopping, but in regards, sometimes, you know, it has to be in one direction because of the turns at the at where the turns occur at the platforms. So you have to do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Archuk and Ms. Burnside. We have a lot of good information and a lot of good message to our customers as well as the employees out of this, and we look forward to the updates as we see how we're progressing. It really is a good message for us. That is all the business for today's customer service and operations. And if no questions, we are adjourned. Thank you.